Labour's ruling National Executive Committee's meeting to decide whether to allow the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, to put himself forward as the party's candidate in the upcoming Gorton and Denton by-election. If the former Health Secretary were returned to Parliament, he would be able to challenge Sir Keir Starmer's leadership. But he's insisted he wants to support the government, not undermine it. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, who will chair the committee that will rule on his political future, told Sunday with Laura Koonsberg that it'll consider what he says.
Andy has said in his own words that Keir is the best person to be the Prime Minister and has made it very clear in his letter what his motivation is for wanting to come into Parliament. I do believe Andy Burnham because I take him at his word. I've never had any reason not to take him at his word. I trust him. As I say, we work very closely together and I am going to take what he says at face value because I know I can do that with Andy.
86 people have been arrested on suspicion of breaching the grounds of Wormwood Scrubs Jail in West London. The Metropolitan Police said the group was protesting in support of a Palestine Action prisoner on a hunger strike. Counter-terror, fraud and criminal gang investigations in the UK will be taken over by a new national police force. The new National Police Service is being likened to a British FBI. Protests have taken place in Minneapolis after a man was shot dead by federal immigration agents. 37-year-old Alex Pretty was a US citizen and a nurse who cared for veterans. The Department of Homeland Security said he was violent and armed. Videos online appear to show no evidence to support the claim he used any armed force to threaten agents. A massive winter storm is heading across the United States towards the northeast, threatening to paralyse parts of the country with heavy snowfall. The National Weather Service is warning of dangerously cold temperatures. The American climber Alex Honnold has succeeded in his attempt to scale a 500-metre-high skyscraper in Taiwan with no rope or protective equipment. It took him just over an hour and a half as crowds cheered him on. And the weather, it'll continue to be cloudy with some patchy rain, heaviest in the southwest and far south of the UK. Highs of 8 degrees Celsius in Cardiff and Belfast, 6 in Edinburgh and 9 in London. BBC News at 12:02. And now, private passions. This edition was recorded before the recent protests in Iran, in which thousands of people have been killed. Michael Barclay's guest today is the actor Paul Chahidi.
Paul Chahidi is an actor whose versatility shines through in prize-winning performances from Shakespeare to satire. He delighted West End and Broadway audiences as Mariah in Twelfth Night and won acclaim from filmgoers as the hapless Nikolai Bulganin in The Death of Stalin. On television, he's played a well-meaning vicar in the BAFTA-winning This Country, an archangel in Good Omens, and he's currently a spook in the BBC thriller The Night Manager. Such shape-shifting came early. Paul was born Giv Khatib Chahidi in Iran before moving as a child to the Oxford countryside. He studied Arabic and Persian at university with an eye to becoming a foreign correspondent before the lure of Shakespeare and Sondheim won him over. Welcome, Paul. You've brought us Vaughan Williams, Chopin, Beethoven and some Iranian music too, which I'm particularly looking forward to. But I think you want to start with Palestrina?
Yes, I developed a love for early and Renaissance music in my, I'd say my late teens onwards. For me, I can't really describe it any better than saying if there were a soundtrack to heaven, this would be it. And whenever I want to focus on something or I'm looking for serenity of some kind, this is one of the pieces I often return to, and I think it's sublime.
Thank you.
It's beautiful, plaintive music.
Mm. I feel it's very contemplative and moving. I mean, I suppose that's what I always look for in music. I think we all do, something that resonates on a deeper level, that cuts straight to one's emotions. I think I'm often struck by modern life, how much more precious it's become to find oases of serenity when you can, when you're bombarded with so much information and so much stimuli. And anything that can offer that, whether it's literature or music or art, is hugely important now more than ever.
Your son Ferito Ahilasso by Palestrina, performed by the Harp Consort Ensemble and their director, Andrew Lawrence King. So your father was Iranian and your mother English, Paul. How did they meet?
Well, it's something like a script of a rom-com, really. I'm sure there was quite a lot of comedy when they met. But my father was studying for his PhD in law at the Sorbonne in Paris in the 50s. And my mum was in Paris at the same time, training to become a teacher of English as a foreign language. And they both were going to French conversational classes at night. And they met there as impoverished students. And, very English woman meeting a very Iranian man in the 50s in Paris. So it was a real melange.
Conversing in French. I think you ought to write a script for this.
Yes, I think there's definitely a comedy in there.
You were born in Iran in 1969, but moved to Britain, to Oxford, when you were a toddler, I think. Why was that?
Yeah, I was about one and a half, I think. Well, my father's studies took him from France to Switzerland and then finally to Oxford, where he was finishing his PhD in international law. And my mother began her training as an anthropologist there, and they loved Oxford. My dad had the opportunity of living in London later on in his career as a diplomat, but he never really wanted to move there. And he just stayed put in Oxford, and that's where our roots are, really.
You spent the summer months going to Iran, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was magical, really. It's such an extraordinary country with the sensual and sensory impact of it. It is very, very vivid still to this day to me. And I used to go back every summer visiting my aunts and uncles and cousins and family friends and running free in the streets of Tehran like an urchin.
Well, talking of music, your father was actually involved in promoting Iranian culture, wasn't he? So your childhood must have been quite full of culture and music.
Yes, absolutely. It was very much a mixed cultural household. So we would eat both English food and a lot of Persian dishes. And we had Persian music, English friends, Iranian friends. It was a really rich and diverse household.
A melting pot.
It was a melting pot. And I feel really, really lucky to have grown up in that atmosphere.
Well, it is Iranian music we're going to hear next. Mm. And tell me what it is.
I could have chosen from thousands of amazing musicians and singers and artists from Iran. I wanted something that would meld perhaps the classical with the folkloric, but in a slightly more modern style. And so what you've got here are Massa and Marjan Vahdat doing this beautiful version of a poem by Hafez, who is one of the great poets of the Persian Golden Age. Sufi poet, yes. So he was a 14th century poet. And his poetry would often be the pop songs of his day. And they would be sung, but they would have many layers to them, one of which was popular and the other of which was very sacred and, you know, Islamic mysticism. And this gives a good representation of how Persian music was, is, and can be.
Promise to my beloved. It has a delicacy, but the actual solo line at the beginning reminded me slightly of the Palestrina.
Well, I think that, I didn't realise this, but when I made my choices, I thought there's definitely a theme going on there. It's certainly in tone, because there is, I would say, a longing to that music that you just heard, and I think that is there in quite a few of my choices. Ironically, I mean, Sufism is an extraordinary manifestation of Islam, and it often, the poetry and art centres around separation from the beloved, which on a human level can be the man or woman that you're in love with, but in terms, on a mystical level, it's your separation from God. And I suppose my teacher at Cambridge, this wonderful man called Peter Avery, who was a world expert on Hafiz, he described it very simply. He said, Sufis believe that there is a transmitter within all of us that connects us to God, but we've forgotten how to tune it in. And Sufism is one way of reconnecting that internal transmitter to create a direct relationship with God, and there are various ways of doing that: meditation, prayer, but also poetry and music. And a lot of Sufi poetry is about love, drinking wine, separation, yearning, and connection.
Part of Promise to My Beloved, from a poem by Hafiz, adapted and performed by Marsa Vahdat alongside her sister Marjan. Well, that brings us very nicely to what I want to talk to you about next, because family trips presumably rather ceased after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And I wonder how much of this sort of music would be allowed now.
Well, as with any country, you have the people and you have the government. And what you will find is there's an image of Iran on the news, which is political and to do with religion, but what you won't see is the true lives of Iranian people: hospitality, warmth, generosity. And behind closed doors, people listen to music, they recite poetry, but certainly, yes, in public life, it is far more prescribed in that sense than it was.
And what happened to your father in 1979 and after Shah's exile?
Well, Dad was, in the last 5 or 6 years leading up to the revolution, he was a diplomat and he was based at the embassy in London. And he went back to Iran just before the revolution to visit family and then get his next posting. And he was unfortunate enough to get caught out there as the revolution broke. So for about 10 months, he was in Iran, unable to leave. My mother and sister and I were back in the UK, and it was a very difficult time for all of us. We would have a call once a week from my father to let us know he was safe, but we wouldn't necessarily know where he was. And after about 10 months, he managed to get out of Iran and get back to the UK. But our lives changed very considerably overnight. I hasten to add, I find it hard to be anything but grateful for the fact that he got out alive and that we still had a house to live in. But my father's career as a diplomat was over, and he rather extraordinarily didn't transfer any of that bitterness onto us as a family. He was quite philosophical about it. But it did mean that I think we as a family had a sense of the impermanence of things, and that life can change very, very suddenly.
So you found yourself with the much quieter life in the Oxfordshire countryside, which might suggest your next music, I suppose.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Vaughan Williams. Well, you know, I don't want to leave my mum out of this, because I love the mixture of cultures and I love British culture, and our life in Oxford was and has been a blessing. And whenever I think of the English countryside, I think of Vaughan Williams, and this piece in particular reminds me of it.
It's a wonderful piece based on a theme by Thomas Tallis, The Fantasia. A lot of the music from that period, Vaughan Williams, Elgar, for example, does actually take inspiration from the countryside. And it has a particular sort of stringiness about it, doesn't it? Which is makes it very touching, especially when you hear it conducted by Sir John Barbirolli as there. That was part of Vaughan Williams's Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis for double string orchestra, played by the Sinfonia of London, conducted, as I said, by Sir John Barbirolli. As a child, were you a happy child or were you actually a difficult child?
I don't think I was a difficult child. I think I spent a lot of my childhood worrying about not letting my parents down. I think the events of the Iranian Revolution in 1979 and what my father and my mother went through as a result of that really brought home how precarious things can become very suddenly. And I think I didn't want to let them down because I felt like they'd been through a lot. I was quite naughty until the age of about seven, and then I settled down. I mean, naughty, getting pea shooters and firing them at passers-by from the bedroom window from our house in Oxford and being chased up the street by people. I mean, that level of naughtiness. Yeah. But then I calmed down. And I think I was... My sister is 7 years older than me, so, and she was away at school and then at university. So a large chunk of my childhood after the revolution was at home alone with my parents. That then led me to have a very rich imaginative life. So I would kind of create characters in my head, and I'm sure that fed into my later life as an actor.
Was music a solace to you as a child at all?
Oh yeah, I didn't really come to classical music until my late teens properly. But I was surrounded by Persian music, both classical and modern. And I think I love the storytelling element that you find in music, and I certainly was drawn to musical theatre. I remember developing a probably quite obsessive love of Jesus Christ Superstar as a child, and I'd listen to it on a loop while I did other things, making model airplanes.
Your father introduced you to this piece, the next piece, the Chopin, I think, although you were a few years older then.
Yeah, I was probably about 17 or so when he first played it, or I noticed it. And it was so arresting and so beautiful and delicate. And I just was drawn to it immediately. And I've listened to it on and off ever since.
Did you play a piano at all?
Well, I had a go, but I was too lazy to continue with it. My father and mother both said to me, "We warn you, you're going to regret this, but we're not going to force you to learn." I think I got to grade one almost, and I'm sure the piano teacher found me the most exasperating student he'd ever had. And I do regret it because I have so many friends who play an instrument and they draw so much enjoyment from it, and I wish I'd stuck with it. So maybe I'll go back to it one day.
I'm afraid grade one would not get you to play the Chopin Nocturne in C-sharp minor.
I know.
So instead we've got Jan Liszewski to play it for us.
Thank you.
Chopin's Nocturne in C-sharp minor, played by Jan Liszewski. Again, an introvert piece in many ways.
It's exquisite, I think. And I think I am an introvert. I think, like, in common with a lot of performers, I'm an introverted extrovert, if that makes sense. Or as I think a friend once described me, a shy show-off. So it does reflect how I feel inside a lot of the time, I think, for me.
And I think that the Chopin was important to you when you were studying in Cairo.
Yes, I studied Arabic and Persian, and one of the years of my degree course gave us the opportunity of living in an Arab country of our choice, and I chose Cairo, and I'm so glad I did, because it is at the time I would say it was the cultural capital of the Arab world for music, literature, cinema, etc., and one of the great cities of the world. And from there I managed to travel to Israel, Palestine, Jordan and elsewhere. And it was an amazing, rich and vivid time in my life. And I would listen to these nocturnes by Chopin so often. And I just found them just really transporting. It reminded me of home. It made me feel quite happy and comforted.
You went to study Persian and Arabic at Cambridge University, switching your alma mater from Oxford.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the reason, Michael, is you don't want to be coming back from a party late at night and then bump into your mum and dad. So I got the hell out of Dodge, as it were. And it wasn't a great change. I have to say, it wasn't a terribly adventurous move. But going to a metropolis like Cairo certainly was. And I really couldn't speak. They didn't teach spoken Arabic terribly well for the first 2 years at Cambridge. It was more like Latin. And when I arrived on the streets of Cairo trying to ask for directions to things, I was laughed at by the locals. And I think I remember on my first week, I was lost. I refused to walk around with a map because I didn't want to look like a tourist, which I obviously did look like. And I ended up having to ask one of the many soldiers on a street corner where the tube was. I discovered later that using my very bad Cambridge-taught Arabic, I was probably asking for the underground in terms of something that sounded like a good burger of Cairo, where is yon subterranean fire chariot? And I think they just loved that. But by the end, I was very proud. I could actually speak a bit of Arabic and talk like a real Cairene with that accent.
We'll come on to your growing interest in drama, but what did you think you might become at this point?
I think in my head, I thought, well, a logical thing would be to use my languages. And I had one thought of perhaps becoming a foreign correspondent. I was interested in the Middle East, its history, its literature, its politics, and I applied to journalism courses and a couple of papers. But then at the same time, the lure of the grease paint drew me in another direction.
You've cast your musical net quite wide now, because we're going to hear some jazz, but it continues the themes that you've already talked about, slight introvert and slight melancholy, because it's the great Miles Davis, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this piece is absolutely wonderful. I mean, I would say it goes from introvert to extrovert in the same piece. So in that sense, I think it's very much something for me.
It's from the seminal album Kind of Blue.
All his works, but particularly this album and particularly this piece, was the backdrop to many a party, many a late night revising session as well.
Which track is it?
It's So What. Thank you. wonderful.
Part of So What, played by Miles Davis, featuring John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley and Bill Evans, extraordinary group of musicians.
Well, isn't it just?
You said you were a shy child, so how did you get drawn into drama at university?
I started later than some people, but I had a teacher. He was that teacher for me, called Simon Elliott, who was an English teacher and had been a very gifted actor himself. And he encouraged us all when we were studying Shakespeare, rather than to sit and study it dryly at our desk, to get up and perform it. And it just brought it to life immediately, and it made it far less of a forced march and far more exciting. And he saw something in me. At that point, I had not stepped foot on a stage or performed in any way other than sort of putting on silly voices at home, which I hasten to add, I did a lot. So there was something there already. But he saw something in me and encouraged this shy boy to get up and perform. And pretty soon I was involved with school plays, and that was the only place I truly started to feel I was being myself. And at university, I fell in with a wonderful group of people, contemporaries, many of whom are now actors, writers, comedians.
People like who?
Well, Mel Giedroyc and Sue Perkins and Jez Butterworth, the writer, and James Harding, who is now, I think, the editor of The Observer. He was a very fine actor, and a lot of very eminent barristers were also in that group. Stephen Mang and Nicola Walker and the late, great and sorely missed Paul Ritter. We all acted together. We were all just larking about and trying things. And it was an extremely creative and exciting time for all of us. And there were friendships formed there that have continued to this day. And it was a very meaningful time in my life.
Interesting, I think, that, you know, in order to find yourself, you had to be somebody else.
Yeah, you've hit on something there. I'm sure I can't be the first person you've had in the studio talking about who's had that experience. We often can express things through the mask of a character that we perhaps can't express so easily in our everyday lives.
Some beautiful medieval choral music now.
Oh, yes. This actually was probably the first piece that then led to all the other pieces and my interest in Renaissance and early music. And we were rehearsing a production of Bulgakov's Moliere, and Paul Ritter was in it. And Dominic Rowan, who is also a professional actor, introduced me to this album of Gothic voices. And it's a mixture of medieval French and Italian pieces. And again, it's a love song expressing yearning for this lady that ignores him. And I was just absolutely bowled over by it. I'd never heard this kind of polyphonic type of choral music before. And it's led to all sorts of new vistas for me in my listening.
Per la Veronesta by Andrea da Firenze.
Yeah.
I always think the kind of holes in the music, the way there are quite large gaps, remind one of the sort of architecture in which it was often performed, probably.
Yes, with the echoing church or cloisters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Per la ver onesta by Andrea da Firenze, performed by Gothic Voices, conducted by Christopher Page. When, Paul, your university course was coming to an end, how difficult was it to decide what you were going to do next?
Well, I did think it's either journalism, using my languages, or performing in some way. And, you know, a lot of my contemporaries were a lot bolder than me in going, we absolutely know what we want to do. We want to train as actors and then we're going to become actors. Or we want to go into comedy, write our own stuff and go into that world. And that was the first time I was put on the spot where I had to decide and make a choice for good or ill and just see what happened. And again, going back to my childhood, I think I'd worried a lot about what my parents would make of this profession. We had no history of anyone in our family doing anything like this. And so I remember rather overdramatically, ironically, sitting them down at the table at home in Oxford and saying, I've got something important I need to tell you. They're probably thinking, who's died? You know, and I was like, I just need you to know I've thought about this a lot and I need to try becoming an actor. And there was this silence and I think my mum and dad both in various ways said, that's absolutely fine. I later discovered from my mum that my dad was absolutely beside himself with worry about how this would work out, because it was like, how are you going to earn a living from this, you know? But they never stood in the way. They're very supportive. I mean, financially, I had to sort of support myself largely. And that was a good thing in a way, because it tested my mettle. But I then started my training. I applied to drama schools. I got into one and I did a 3-year training course as an actor at the Central School of Speech and Drama. And I found that very hard, if I'm honest, because there was a lot of insecurity internally at that point, going, have I made a mistake? Will any of this work out? And not feeling like I necessarily fitted in to that world. So it wasn't the easiest of beginnings, but it was a good crucible in which to sort of test my resilience for what was to come, I think.
Did you know what kind of actor you wanted to be?
I'd done a bit of everything. I'd written and performed comedy with friends at university, but also done far more straight stuff. I wanted to start with Shakespeare, and I wanted to explore the classical canon in some way. And then see where that led. But theatre was the reason I became an actor, and the film and television work came much later on.
Paul Tahidi, it's actually Sondheim next, not Shakespeare. Yes. why this?
Oh, well, I think, you know, he's It's an overused word. He is a genius. He was the maestro of the musical theatre genre. And it was in our first year at Central. We had to have singing lessons and work as a choir. And one of the first pieces we all learnt was the piece you're going to hear next, which is from Sunday in the Park with George. It's called Sunday. It's the finale. And when we sang it, it just brought us all together, and the depth and complexity and beauty of it was extraordinary. And by the end, when we finished singing it, we were all in tears. And I came back to it many years later as a member of the audience. And you're going to hear a recording with the cast that I went to see. And I had the same experience. I was in absolute floods of tears at the end.
Design. Tension. Composition. Balance. Light. Dot. I cannot read this word.
Harmony.
So much love in his words, forever with his colors. How George looks, he can look forever. What does he see? His eyes, so dark and shiny, so careful, so exact. White, a blank page or a canvas. His favorite. So many possibilities.
So although you couldn't play us the Chopin, you could have sung us the Sondheim.
Just about my line, anyway, the bass baritone. Yeah.
We heard the finale of Sunday in the Park with George by Stephen Sondheim, performed by Daniel Evans, Jenna Russell, and the London cast from 2006. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the actor Paul Chahidi. You've gone on to a successful career on stage and screen, Paul, since those faltering drama school days. But I did want to ask you about one particular standout theatre performance and how you prepared for it. It's Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, where you played Maria.
Yes, gosh, that turned into something much bigger than anyone expected, for all of us involved. Mark Rylance, who was artistic director of the Globe, a wonderful, brilliant actor, and his wife, Claire Van Kampen, the composer and playwright, were running the Globe, and they gave me some of my earliest breaks. And it culminated in them saying, look, we're going to explore some elements of what were called original practices from Shakespeare's day, and one of these is that, you know, they didn't have women playing the female roles. They had men. So it was an all-male production of Twelfth Night. And we would like you to play the part of Maria. And I was like, I don't know about, you know, what I think a woman should be playing that. But, you know, let's explore this and see. It seems like a kind of one-off sort of interesting project to do. So I ended up playing it at, firstly, the Middle Temple Hall. It was on the 400th anniversary of its original performance, which was itself at Middle Temple Hall. We were there doing it 400 years later in original costume, all handmade. I think my costume cost something like £10,000. It's now somewhere in the V&A. And we were pinned in, no Velcro, no hooks and eyes. And 10 years later, it was revived and we went from the Globe to the West End to Broadway. And it was the most extraordinary journey, playing that role and working with that group of actors in that way.
How do you play a role like Maria without resorting to sort of obvious clichés?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I just thought, I want this to be truthful. I don't want it to be a parody. And I just treated it, therefore, as I would any character and let the gender come really last, in the sense that I just wanted to see what this character wanted from other people, what they said about themselves, what they said about other people, what the inner life of this character might be. And it just happened to be a woman. Now, what I then discovered was, once you get into a corset and five layers of clothing, you are trussed up so tightly, you can only move in a certain way. And people will still to this day talk about the production and remark on how the men playing the women would glide across the stage. And what we were doing was moving in the only way that you really could with that costume, which was rather like a duck. You know, you're serene on top and paddling away like crazy underneath with these tiny little tippy-toed footsteps.
So were there any memorable preparations in getting ready for the role of Maria?
Well, in our first outing, we were at the Middle Temple Hall, and Eddie Redmayne was our viola. He was still at university finishing his degree. And we were required to wax our bodies. I hasten to say it was the top half only, thank goodness. as anyone with Iranian or Middle Eastern heritage will tell you, there's often quite a lot of hair to deal with. And we really didn't think anything of it. Eddie and I, when we were told this, went, oh, great, how bad can it be? This is hilarious. What fun. What an adventure. So we were booked into what I can only describe as a backstreet waxing parlour in Southwark. I think the Globe's budget was quite limited at that point. And Eddie and I went into this parlour very nonchalantly. And all I'll say is that the screams could be heard probably all the way to St Albans. I mean, it was one of the most painful things ever.
I can't help asking you, since you talked about how the clothes and being trussed up helped you find the part, what it was like to perform at the Globe Theatre in London, which adds another element of reality, if you like.
Well, the Globe's unlike any other theatre I've ever worked in. It's a roofless wooden O, 1,500 people, 500 people standing right up to the edge of the stage. You don't have any lights really to help focus the audience's attention. You have minimal set. You have music, which is integral, costume, and then it's just the actors and the words. And that was very, very visceral. But it was quite a journey because really I can't emphasise how much in those early days the Globe was being dismissed as a space. And you've got to pay tribute to Sam Wanamaker. It took an American to come over here and go, I've got this idea, this dream, that we should build a theatre on the original site, or as near as, damn it, the original site of Shakespeare's Globe. And people will come. And, you know, people mocked him to begin with, but he stuck with it. And look at it now. It's extraordinary.
It's fascinating that there is a sort of musical corollary to what you've been talking about in the way we've gone back to period instruments and early music.
Yeah.
And it's opened a whole new world, really, a new way of listening.
Yeah, absolutely.
John Dowland next, which takes us very conveniently, period-wise, to that sound. Dowland, of course, made almost a thing of melancholy. So many of his pieces are called drop, tears, yes. Lacrimae, but they're very moving.
They're very moving. And again, I just find them uplifting at the same time. I feel more alive after listening to it.
Sun in
Flow My Tears by John Dowland, sung by Yestyn Davis, with Thomas Dunford playing the lute. Paul, you've been in many films. You have an early credit in Notting Hill with Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant, where you played a hugely demanding role, didn't you?
Very, very demanding. I was in a restaurant scene with, amongst others, Sanjeev Bhaskar, and it featured Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant, and we were these loud men being rude about Julia Roberts. I was so looking forward to it. I was so nervous leading up to the day. I prepared my one line. I was ready to make an impact. And then we got to filming. Sanjeev had all his lines and my one line was cut, Michael. Now, funnily enough, I had more calls from relatives around the globe saying, we saw you in this film. I was like, but I've just done Shakespeare, so can we talk about that? Yeah.
You had many more lines in Amanda Iannucci's historical comedy, The Death of Stalin, which came out in 2017. What was your role?
I was Nikolai Bulganin, who was the foreign minister. And it was, an extraordinary thing to be involved with. If I tell you that the most outlandish moments in that film are all fact, and the boring bits are the ones we had to make up, you'll get an idea of how insane and terrible that period must have been.
It's a funny, even absurd film, and I wonder whether you approach serious drama and comedy in different ways.
Whether you're doing comedy or tragedy or something non-comedic, I think what you want to start with is the truth of the situation, the truth of that character, and play them as real as possible. You can then dial up the scale and the kind of the manicness or otherwise of the character or the situation, but it has to be rooted in something real. And usually that is a vulnerability. And if you find that, then you can go anywhere with a character and play it at any scale. And I would say that actually with comedy, yes, you have to have a sense of the comedic rhythms of a piece and be aware of the structure of the writing, but really, what you're looking for, in a sense, is to play it as straight as possible and let the comedy take care of itself.
We're going to have more music now from your native Iran. Music you've been with you since childhood, really.
Yes, what you've got now is the great chanteuse Haideh singing Golesangam, which is a very well-known Persian folk song, but then also translated into disco, which you'll hear here, and it holds a very special place in my heart. It's one of the first Iranian pop songs I can remember hearing and learning as a child. And later on, it was sung at my wedding to my wife, Kate, by my lovely Aunt Parry, who's sadly no longer with us, who had a very beautiful voice. She sang that a cappella at our wedding. I also used to sing it a cappella in a far less beautiful version to my son as a lullaby to get him to sleep. And then it featured again with my Aunt Parry, because when she was dying, I would visit her. And the last time I saw her, I don't quite know why, but she wasn't speaking anymore, but I sang it to her and held her hand, and because we have that connection through that song.
Come here.
So that's something you play over and over again.
I do. I've got so... It's played... It's woven into my life.
Part of Gule Sangam, composed and played by Anushiravan Rohani and sung by Hayede. A role you've made your own, which is much more English countryside than your Persian roots, is the vicar in the television series This Country. Just tell us about the premise for this show.
Well, This Country is, it's really in many ways a show about boredom and what happens in a small village where not very much is going on. And it centres around these two tearaway characters called Kerry and Curtin, who are cousins and who don't have anything to do and misbehave and... their only sort of seemingly only father figure in their life is the local vicar, who has the patience of a saint. And many of the episodes centered around them getting into all sorts of trouble in the village and then the vicar having to sort it out in some way.
So you're the sort of straight man in the comedy, dispensing good sense amongst the chaos.
Yeah, very much so. And that was not easy, I have to say, because Charlie and Daisy Cooper, who play Kerry and Curtin, are very funny people. The writing was very funny, and they would often try and make me laugh during filming to torture me. But yes, it was a brilliant thing to be part of.
It's very naturalistic, doesn't feel scripted. Is some of it improvised?
It's mainly scripted, but there is some improvisation. And it, in common with Armando Iannucci, who did Death of Stalin, Tom George and Simon Mayhew Archer, the director and producer respectively, would do about, say, five takes of a scene as scripted, and we would stick to the script, and then always they'd say at the end, we're going to do a couple of takes, we can go a bit loosey-goosey, as they call it, but don't take the scene completely off the rails, but you can improvise. And I'd say 90% of the time we didn't use stuff that was improvised, but then that 10% would occasionally produce these little treasures, whether in a physical reaction or some improvised dialogue.
Do you need quite a lot of confidence, even chutzpah, to improvise with other actors? Is becoming more extrovert, slipping further and further away from the introvert in your case?
Yeah, absolutely. I think acting has taken me out of my shell so much. But I think if you say to most British actors, right, we're going to improvise the scene now, the blood will drain from their face and they'll look for the nearest exit. So, you know, I do remember, I'm not naming any names, but there's some very, very eminent British actors in Death of Stalin who we were told we might improvise some bits, and I genuinely thought they were going to run away. And by the end, we were all having a go at it. And actually, once you give yourself up to it, it's wonderful, because you really are listening and being in the moment with the other actors, which is what acting is. It's about listening as much as it is about speaking.
You're currently playing a senior intelligence officer in the BBC's second series of The Night Manager. There are several layers of deceit going on, but you're very good at looking innocent.
Am I good? I'm glad.
Perhaps you are an innocent at heart.
Well, maybe I am innocent, Michael. My lips are very much sealed. But I mean, as with all Le Carré characters, you're not quite sure of their true intentions until he's good and ready to reveal it. So, yes, it's a wonderful role to play. And David Farr, our brilliant writer, who has written this second instalment with no source novel. Le Carré only wrote one Night Manager. There were no sequels to it in his writing. And it turned out that David had written this part with me in mind. He'd written it as Basil Karapetian, as a British with Armenian-Iranian heritage. Now, I'm not Armenian-Iranian. I'm British Iranian, but he wanted that melange of cultures within the establishment because it's A, interesting, and B, true to life. And so it's been wonderful to be able to draw on my dual heritage.
Well, we can celebrate with your final work, can't we? Because it's the apotheosis of the dance, as
yes.
Wagner called it. Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. How did you come to focus on this for your final piece?
I came to it, I think it was during the time I was doing Death of Stalin. I was looking for pieces that would take me to a place of seriousness within something seemingly comedic, to root me in that world. And it's a personal thing. Of course, he's not Russian, you know, but I felt like this was something with enormous weight and depth to it. And it spoke to me of human endurance and perseverance and hope. And it goes from the epic to the intimate, which I think is at the heart of all good drama.
We're going to hear the Allegretto from the Seventh Symphony in A Major by Beethoven. So, Paul Chahidi, thank you very much for letting the mask slip just an inch or two.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure, Michael.
The opening of the second movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 7 in A major, a live recording from 2019 by the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the actor Paul Chahidi. The programme was produced by Katie Hickman. And next week, Michael's guest will be the botanist Sandra Knapp, whose work has taken her to remote regions of Central and Southern America and beyond. She specialises in the plant genus Solanum, potatoes, tomatoes and aubergines, and some of her music choices will reflect her background in botany.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
Lose yourself in the sounds and stories of the past. Each week, we travel back in time to explore medieval, Renaissance and Baroque music.
It's important to remember how good this music is.
Bach uses the flute in a more soloistic way. It was really interesting doing these arrangements.
The Early Music Show with me, Hannah French. Listen Sunday evenings from 5 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Choral Evensong at 3 o'clock comes from St Paul's Cathedral. But now at 1:30, time here on BBC Radio 3 to join Sarah Moore-Peach on a journey to Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, with stops en route via composers including Imogen Holst, Thomas Tallis and Caroline Shaw.
Hello, I'm Sarah Moore-Peach. Welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. On today's show, we're being thrust into the heart of the orchestra. This is Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, our destination on today's show. A masterful set of variations on a theme which shows off the glory and variety of the symphony orchestra, inspiring the generations. We'll hear the whole thing in about an hour's time, and before that we're going to make musical connections that help us listen more deeply. Let's begin our map with the original melody that Britten based his piece on, a work of stage music by the 17th century Henry Purcell, a rondo from Abdelazer. Jean Lamont directing Tafelmusik in the